Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling something that, well, seems utterly simple on the surface, but is actually incredibly profound. How does a child learn what a word means? You know, that moment a toddler points and says, car, correctly, looks easy, almost automatic.
It really does. But that apparent simplicity is deceptive. We're diving into Paul Bloom's work today, and he argues pretty convincingly that learning a word is... well, it's basically a miracle.
Kind of miracle. That sounds strong.
It is, but I think it's justified. For cognitive science, this isn't just about kids learning vocabulary lists. It hits right at the core of how language connects to thought, you know,
right.
And what human learning is even like.
Okay. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack that miracle. We're following Bloom's analysis chapter by chapter, looking at the whole journey. It sounds like it involves way more than just hearing a word and seeing a thing. We're talking concepts, social smarts, understanding language structure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just to map a simple sound like E, O, G onto the incredibly rich idea of dog. It's not just association. We need to explore the foundations that make it possible for you, for me, for everyone.
All right, let's jump in. Where do we start? With the big philosophical problem children just solve.
We have to start there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it highlights why just looking and listening isn't enough. It's the problem of reference. Quine's Gavagai thought experiment is the classic illustration.
Ah, yes, Gavagai. So remind us, the setup is a linguist in a completely foreign land, right?
Exactly. You're with a native speaker. You got no dictionary, nothing. A rabbit hops by, the speaker points and says, Gavagai.
And naturally, we assume Gavagai means rabbit, the whole rabbit.
We do. But how do we know? Or how does a child know? Logically, Gavagai could mean, well, almost anything related to that scene.
Like what?
It could mean the whole rabbit, sure.
Yeah.
Or maybe just that specific rabbit at that specific moment in time, a rabbit stage. Or it could mean its color, whiteness, or its action, hopping, or Quine's famous, slightly absurd example. All and sundry undetached parts of rabbits.
Undetached rabbit parts. Right, so the physical event itself, seeing the rabbit, hearing the sound, doesn't actually narrow it down.
Not logically, no.
Yeah.
There's just this huge, potentially infinite space of possible meanings. The world doesn't tell you which one is right.
So the child somehow has to filter out all these crazy possibilities even before they start learning?
Precisely. And that's just the first hurdle. Let's say, okay, somehow the child does land on whole rabbit. Now they face Goodman's problem, generalization.
How do they know to apply Gavagai to the next rabbit they see? Or a picture of a rabbit?
Exactly. Why not extend it to mean white things or fluffy things?
Right.
Or Goodman's even weirder example, rabbits. But only up until the year 2000, after which it means carrots.
Okay, that's just bizarre. But it makes the point.
It does. There's no logical reason, based only on the evidence, to prefer the category rabbit over these other stranger categories. The solution can't be found in logic applied to the input.
So, it must be inside the child's head, the structure of their mind.
That's the conclusion. The human mind must come equipped with certain biases or constraints that favor certain kinds of concepts, like whole object over others. It's the mind structure, not the world structure, that solves this.
And this internal structure explains why word learning is so robust, even when the learning conditions aren't perfect.
Absolutely. We tend to picture this ideal scene. Parent points, child looks, parent says the word, perfect alignment.
The classic naming game.
Right. But research shows that even in, say, typical Western households where parents do interact a lot, the perfect alignment only happens maybe 70% of the time.
So 30% of the time, the word the child hears doesn't match what they're looking at.
Yeah. The parent might be talking about something out of sight, or the child might be looking at, I don't know, a fork, while the parent says, time for your milk.
If it were just association, wouldn't the child sometimes think milk means fork?
You'd expect those errors all the time. But they're incredibly rare. Children seem remarkably good at tuning out that noise and figuring out the intended meaning anyway.
And they don't need constant correction or feedback either.
That's another big myth. The idea that parents meticulously correct every misuse. First, evidence suggests they don't. Not really for meaning anyway, maybe for grammar later.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, learning happens even without feedback loops. Mm-hmm. Think about cultures where adults don't really talk to young children until the children start talking themselves.
They still learn language just fine.
They do. And consider cases of children who are nonverbal, maybe due to a physical issue, but have normal hearing. They can develop huge vocabularies just by listening.
How can they be getting feedback if they can't speak?
They can't. It proves that reinforcement, in the behavioral sense, isn't the driver for learning word meanings. They build the knowledge internally.
Okay, that's compelling. But what about cases where the input itself is limited? The example of the blind child, Kelly, seems crucial here.
Kelly's case is fascinating. She was blind from birth, yet she developed a basically normal understanding of color words.
How is that possible if she couldn't see colors?
Well, she obviously couldn't link the word red to the visual experience of red.
Mm.
But she learned about color words. She knew they formed a category. She knew they applied to objects. She knew red and blue were colors, but, say, loud wasn't.
So she learned the conceptual domain even without the sensory data.
Exactly. She must have picked it up from how people talked about colors, the linguistic context, the social function. It shows how powerful these other learning routes are, strong enough to overcome a complete lack of direct sensory evidence for that specific domain.
So if it's not just sensing, and it's robust against noise and lack of feedback, what is being learned? What's the structure of a word's meaning in the mind?
This brings us back to basics, to Saussurean signs. Essentially, learning a word means forming a mental concept, the signified, and linking it to a sound pattern, the signifier.
Like linking the idea of a dog to the sound dog.
Precisely. And crucially, that link is arbitrary. There's nothing dog-like about the sound itself. It's a convention we learn.
And these concepts aren't just simple labels. You mentioned the word book having complex semantics.
Yeah, even seemingly simple nouns are incredibly rich. Chomsky pointed this out. Book can mean the physical object. I have 5 books. Countable, tangible.
Right.
Or it can mean the abstract content. John wrote a book. That's the information, the story. It's not countable in the same way. It can exist in many copies or just as an idea.
And kids just absorb this distinction.
They seem to, yeah. Without anyone explicitly teaching them about abstract versus concrete entities, they grasp this polysemy, the multiple related meanings, which shows they're acquiring deep concepts, not just linking sounds to pictures.
Okay, so wrapping up this first part. Word learning isn't some simple add-on. It relies on really fundamental cognitive abilities, how we form concepts, how we remember, how we figure out what others mean.
Exactly. And building on that complexity, the next chapter tackles the sheer speed of it all. This leads us to fast mapping.
Fast mapping. That's the idea that kids can learn a word from just one or two exposures.
Oh, right? It's just one, yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes in really casual, non-obvious contexts, it's incredibly efficient.
The classic study here is Carey and Bartlett's chromium tray experiment.
That's the one. It really shifted the conversation. They had these 3 and 4-year-olds, and they needed an olive green tray. The experimenter casually said, "Bring me the chromium tray, not the blue one, the chromium one."
So just contrasting it with a known color, blue.
Right. And the kids, just from that single exposure, inferred that chromium must be the name of this new color, olive green.
Okay, that's quick learning. But did it stick?
That was the amazing part. Weeks later, like 1 week and even 6 weeks later, many of the children still remembered something about chromium. Maybe not the exact shade, but they knew it was a color word.
Wow. From one casual mention, that does seem like a specialized skill.
It seemed that way initially, like maybe kids have a dedicated word learning device that does this fast mapping. But then Bloom and Markson did some crucial follow-up work.
What did they find?
They basically showed that this fast mapping ability is not unique to words. Kids, and adults too, are just as good at fast mapping other kinds of arbitrary facts.
Such as?
Well, in their studies, people were shown a novel object. They were told its name, say, Koba. And they were also told an arbitrary fact about it, like it came from a place called Koba.
Okay, name versus a non-linguistic fact.
Right. And a month later, people were just as likely to remember the arbitrary fact about its origin as they were to remember its name. Fast mapping wasn't word-specific.
So, if it's not just for words, what is it for? Why are we so good at instantly learning certain kinds of arbitrary information, but maybe not others, like where I left my keys?
That's the million-dollar question they tackled. Why names and facts, but not, say, the arbitrary location of a sticker you just placed?
Yeah.
The hypothesis is that fast mapping is specifically tuned for socially transmitted information that you can't just figure out by looking. Things like names, origins, maybe hidden properties.
Yeah, means you need someone else to tell you.
Exactly. Think about it functionally. An object's name is a social convention. Its history, or where it came from, is a fact stored in other people's heads. If you forget it, you need an informant.
Whereas if I forget where I put the sticker,
you can just look around. The information is stored in the world. The idea is that the brain has this rapid uptake mechanism specifically for information that's fragile, that relies on social transmission, because if you don't grab it now, you might lose access to it.
Is there direct evidence for this distinction between social hidden facts and observable facts?
There is. They did another clever study, showed people a novel object, told them its name, told them its external visible color, and told them its internal hidden color, like it's white on the inside.
Okay, name, hidden fact, observable fact.
And what they found was that people remembered the name and the internal color, the hidden, non-observable fact, significantly better than they remember the external observable color.
Wow. So we prioritize encoding the stuff we can't just check by looking again.
It seems so. It reframes fast mapping away from being a purely linguistic thing. It looks more like a general, super-fast learning mechanism for crucial social or hidden information.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, speaking of the timing of learning, we have to talk about the word spurt. This idea that vocabulary suddenly takes off around 16 or 18 months, is that real?
It's a very persistent idea, but the evidence suggests it's largely a myth, or at least an oversimplification.
Why do people think it happened?
Well, if you just plot the total number of words a child knows, it looks like the curve suddenly gets steeper around that age. It suggested maybe the child suddenly cracked the code of naming.
But that's not what's really going on.
When you look closely at the rate of learning how many new words per day, the increase is much more gradual, much more linear. It starts slow and just steadily increases.
So there's no sudden aha moment where the rate jumps dramatically?
Not really, no. The rate might be, say, 0.3 words a day between 12, 16 months, and it just keeps climbing steadily.
And when does the rate actually peak? Is it in toddlerhood?
No. That's the surprising part. The peak rate of vocabulary acquisition actually happens much later, often in late childhood or even early adolescence. We're talking maybe 8 to 10 years old, sometimes hitting rates of over 10, maybe even 12 words a day.
12 words a day? That's incredible.
It is. And it often keeps accelerating slightly right up until the late teens. So the really massive vocabulary growth happens when kids are in school, not when they're toddlers. The spurt idea was probably an artifact of how the cumulative data looks over that short toddler period.
Okay, so the timing is gradual. What about the nature of those very first words kids use? Are they somehow different, less symbolic than adult words?
Bloom argues strongly against that idea. He suggests children's first words are fundamentally the same kind of symbolic representations as adult words.
But what about things like overextensions? You know, a kid calling every four-legged animal doggy or calling the cookie jar a cookie. Doesn't that show confusion?
It might look like confusion, but it's often interpreted as a smart strategy given their limitations. They have maybe 50 words, right?
Yeah.
And very little grammar.
So they use the words they do have flexibly.
Exactly. Huttenlocher and Smiley's research suggested these overextensions are often context-dependent communication attempts. The child probably knows the difference between a dog and a cat, conceptually. They just don't have the word cat yet, so they use the closest thing they have, doggy, to refer to it.
So it's a vocabulary problem, not a concept problem.
Largely, yes. And even when they use cookie for the jar, they also use it for actual cookies, for pictures of cookies.
Yeah.
Suggesting the underlying concept is already quite abstract and not tied just to one specific instance. They're using symbols from the get-go.
Okay, so we've got this incredibly fast, robust learning system, and it's not just simple association. It works even with messy input. If it's not raw statistics, what is the driving force? This seems to point directly towards the social aspect, theory of mind.
Absolutely. The failure of simple associationism, the idea going back to Locke that you just pair sounds with experiences, is pretty clear.
Hmm.
We've mentioned the noisy input, right? 30-50% misalignment. Associationism also relies heavily on this idea of explicit, ostensive naming, the parent pointing and labeling clearly.
Which, as you said, doesn't happen everywhere. It's culturally specific.
Right. In many cultures, kids learn primarily by listening in, without adults directly labeling things for them. If association was the main game, kids in those cultures should really struggle, but they learn language just fine.
So the only thing that seems to work across all these variations, noisy input, different cultural practices, is the child's ability to figure out what the speaker means to say.
Exactly. It has to be based on inferring the speaker's intention. And that requires theory of mind, Tom, understanding that other people have minds, with beliefs, desires, goals, and, crucially for word learning, referential intentions. They intend to talk about something.
And kids have this ability really early.
Surprisingly early. We know by 9 months or so, infants are following their caregiver's gaze. That's huge. They're looking where you're looking.
Trying to figure out what you're paying attention to.
Yes. And by about a year, They're doing more active things, like gaze alternation. They'll look at an interesting toy, then look at the adult, then back at the toy.
Like saying, hey, look at this thing with me.
Pretty much. They're actively trying to direct the adult's attention and establish joint focus. This social machinery is already running before significant word learning takes off.
Which sets the stage for that Baldwin-Modi experiment you mentioned earlier. That seems like a direct test.
It's a fantastic demonstration. So, just to recap, an 18-month-old is playing with object A. The experimenter looks over at object B in a bucket and says enthusiastically, it's a Modi.
Okay. The sound Modi occurs while the child is physically focused on object A.
Right. So pure association, Lockean pairing, predicts the child should link Modi to object A.
But they don't.
They don't. They link Modi to object B, the thing the experimenter was looking at and showing clear intention towards. They use the speaker's gaze and interest as the primary cue to reference, overriding their own immediate sensory experience.
That's powerful evidence for Tom in action. Does this apply beyond just object names, like for actions or verbs?
It seems to. There's related work on action imitation. If a researcher demonstrates an action, say, trying to pull apart a toy, and acts like they succeeded there, toddlers are more likely to imitate that goal-directed action.
Uh-huh.
But if the researcher performs the exact same physical movements but acts like it was an accident, oops, the toddlers are much less likely to copy it.
So they're not just copying movements, they're copying perceived intentions or goals.
Exactly. They're sensitive to the emotional and intentional cues surrounding the action, not just the physical kinematics. This feeds into understanding verb meanings, too, which are often about intended actions.
This focus on intention also helps explain something called the principle of contrast, right? Sometimes called mutual exclusivity.
Yes, that's the idea that kids assume new words refer to new things.
Mm-hmm.
If they already have a word for something, they expect a different word to refer to something else.
The classic example. Show a kid a banana they know and a weird new kitchen gadget, like a whisk. Ask for the Fendel.
They'll hand you the whisk every time because they already have a word for banana. So this new word, Fendel, must refer to the other thing.
Now, is this like a built-in rule specifically for language? Or is it also based on this social reasoning?
Bloom argues strongly it's a pragmatic inference based on Tom, not a rigid linguistic constraint.
How can we tell the difference?
Well, think about the reasoning process. The child isn't just applying a rule like one object, one name. They seem to be thinking something like, okay, this adult is trying to communicate effectively. That's Tom. They know the word banana. If they wanted the banana, they would have said banana. Yeah. Since they used a weird new word, Fendel, they must be talking about the other thing here, the whisk.
So it's reasoning about the speaker's likely communicative strategy.
Exactly. It's like the example with colored cards. If you learn red card means pick the cube, and then I show you an orange card next to a sphere, you'll instantly infer orange means pick the sphere.
Right. Yeah, because you would have used red if you meant the cube.
Precisely. It's a general principle of informative communication applied to word learning, not purely lexical.
And this social understanding connects back to the Saussurean sign idea, that words work both ways.
It does. The child sees an adult use dog with the intention of referring to a dog. Through Tom, the child grasps that intention. Then they make the crucial leap. Okay, if they can use that sound with that intention, then I can use that sound with the same intention.
It's like learning through imitation, but imitating the intent behind the word use, not just the sound.
Very much like Miltsov's findings on imitating goal-directed actions. You grasp the goal, and then you can reproduce the action to achieve the same goal. Here, the goal is reference.
Okay, if Tom and intentional inference are so central, what happens if that ability is impaired? This is where the evidence from autism comes in, right?
Yes, and it's really strong support. Children with autism often show marked difficulties with theory of mind tasks, understanding others' beliefs, intentions, perspectives.
So how do they do on word learning tasks, like the Modi experiment?
They typically fail the discrepant looking task. Unlike typically developing children, or even mentally handicapped children, matched for overall cognitive ability, but without Tom deficits, children with autism tend to make the associative error.
They link Modi to the object they were holding.
Yes. They seem to rely more on the simple temporal co-occurrence, the Lockean pairing, because they aren't effectively using the speaker's intentional cues, like gaze, to override it.
So the contrast between autistic children and other groups really highlights the necessity of Tom for typical word learning.
It provides very compelling, almost clinical evidence that this social inferential capacity is not just helpful, it's a core component of the mechanism.
All right, we've established the social machinery inferring intent is key, but you can't map a word onto a meaning if you don't have the meaning structured in your head first. So the next part is about the conceptual prerequisites, right? How kids carve up the world before they start naming it. #A, objects and individuals, chapter 4.
Exactly. We need to look at the conceptual landscape the child brings to the task. And one of the most fundamental aspects is their understanding of objects.
This explains why kids' early words are so often object names, ball, cup, dog. Not because they're easier to say, but because object is a really solid concept for them early on.
That's the idea. They come into the world, or at least develop very early, a way of parsing the visual scene into distinct bounded things. This draws heavily on the work of people like Elizabeth Spelk.
The Spelk object principles? What are those again?
They're these core principles that infants seem to use to decide what counts as a single, coherent object. The main ones are cohesion, objects move as connected wholes, continuity, objects move on connected paths, solidity, objects can't pass through each other, and contact, objects usually affect each other only when they touch.
Let's focus on cohesion. How does that help a baby know if they're seeing one thing or two things?
Okay, imagine an infant looking at something that looks like a single pyramid. If you then lift the top part and the base stays sitting on the table,
that violates cohesion. It didn't move as one connected thing.
Right. And studies show infants are surprised by this. That surprise indicates their internal system expected it to move as a whole. When it didn't, they infer, that must actually be two separate objects.
So this isn't learned. It's like a built-in way of parsing the world into things that can then receive names.
It seems to be a fundamental pre-linguistic way of individuating the world. You need to know what the potential things are before you can start mapping labels onto them. #BB, naming individuals versus kinds. Chapter 5.
Okay, so the baby can parse the world into individual objects, but then language throws different kinds of names at them. Not just dog for the category, but Fido for a specific dog, or him, which could refer to any male dog depending on context. How do they sort out these different types of names, particularly proper names versus common nouns?
That's another layer of conceptual understanding. They need to grasp the difference between naming a kind, dog, and naming a unique individual, Fido. And research, like Gail Hall's, suggests they use specific cues.
What kind of cues?
Two really stand out. First, the type of entity being named. And second, the consistency or fidelity of how the name is used.
Let's start with entity type. Are some things more likely to get proper names than others?
Definitely. Kids seem to expect proper names primarily for entities that are special, unique, and often animate or treated as intentional agents. So, people, pets, maybe special dolls.
But probably not a random brick or spoon?
Generally not, unless you specifically animate it or treat it as special. Generic interchangeable items usually get common nouns, brick, not proper names, Bobby the Brick. This suggests the child's understanding of animacy and individuality influences their expectations about naming.
Okay, and the second cue, fidelity of reference. This connects to those anecdotes about kids getting upset if a name is reused.
Exactly. A common noun like dog applies to all members of the kind. But a proper name, like Kieran or Rebecca in those anecdotes, is expected to refer consistently and uniquely to one specific individual.
So when McNamara's son Kieran heard another baby called Lisa, he objected because he already knew a Lisa.
Yes, he seemed to operate under a strict one name, one person rule initially. And the other child, Matthew, refusing to call a new baby Rebecca because his sitter's friend was Becca. It shows they grasped that proper names are meant to pick out unique individuals.
And they understand this concept of unique individuals before they fully master the naming conventions.
It appears so. Evidence suggests that even pre-linguistic infants can track individual objects over time, even identical-looking ones. They seem to have concepts for both kinds, grouping similar things, and specific individuals, tracking unique entities. This dual system is crucial for things like basic number sense and keeping track of social agents like a mental Rolodex. Language then maps onto this pre-existing conceptual structure. #CC. Categories and essences. Chapter 6.
Okay, the conceptual structure goes deeper than just objects and individuals. How do kids form categories? Is it just based on what things look like?
No, and this is a really critical point. Human categorization, especially for natural kinds like animals and plants, seems to go beyond surface appearance. It relies on a belief in essentialism.
Essentialism. The idea that things have a hidden underlying nature or essence that makes them what they are.
Precisely. For biological kinds, this essence is often thought of implicitly, like genetics or internal structure. It determines the category, even if the appearance changes.
So, the example of putting a tiger in a lion suit.
Kids will still insist it's a tiger. The costume doesn't change its underlying tigerness. Gelman and Markman's studies were key here.
The dinosaur example, too.
Yeah, that one's striking. Kids learn a brontosaurus, a dinosaur, has cold blood, and a rhino, looks similar to a triceratops, has warm blood. Then you show them a triceratops.
Which looks more like the rhino.
Right. But kids don't generalize based on looks. They're told the triceratops is also a dinosaur, so they infer it also has cold blood, like the brontosaurus, because they share that deeper category, that dinosaur essence.
So the category, sometimes signaled by the word itself, points to this hidden essence overriding appearance.
Exactly. Essentialism seems to be a powerful, perhaps innate, bias in how we think about natural kinds. It's adaptive because it often reflects biological reality.
What about things humans make? Artifacts like chairs or tools, they don't have a biological essence.
True. For artifacts, the essence seems to be more about function and creator's intention.
Yeah.
What was it made for?
So how something looks is less important than what it does or what someone intended it to do.
That's what the research suggests. Kemmler Nelson, for instance, showed kids novel objects. If we were told an object was a stennet and shown it was used for, say, making a specific pattern, they would generalize the name stennet to other objects that perform the same function. Even if they looked quite different, they prioritize function over shape.
So artifacts are categorized based on their intended purpose, their sort of psychological essence, #D, naming representations, chapter 7. This reliance on intention seems to extend even further, right? To naming things like pictures or drawings.
Yes. When we call a picture of a dog, we're not actually naming the animal itself. We're naming the representation.
Which is really an artifact paper with marks on it.
Exactly. It's an artifact created with a specific representational intention. The child needs to understand that the marks were meant to stand for something else.
And this understanding of intent can even override how good the picture is. The anecdote about the child, Simon, and his scribble.
Oh, that's a perfect illustration.
Yeah.
Simon, at 3 years old, makes this wild scribble that looks like nothing on earth. But he confidently declares, it's mommy and daddy.
Because that's who he intended to draw.
Precisely.
Yeah.
His representational intent was the sole basis for the name he gave it. The actual visual resemblance was irrelevant to him in that moment. It shows that this intentional stance, understanding that names relate to intended reference, applies even to the child's own creative and sometimes failed attempts at representation. So we've got the social inference engine theory of mind, and we've got the foundational conceptual structures, objects, kinds, essences, intentions. These are powerful, maybe even sufficient for learning basic concrete nouns. But for other types of words, especially more abstract ones, or words that aren't nouns, children seem to need another source of information. The language itself. The syntax.
So grammar helps you learn word meanings. It's not just about combining words you already know.
Right. Syntax acts like a set of clues to narrow down the possible meanings of a new word. It's not strictly necessary for learning dog or mommy, but it becomes really important for other things.
Like what?
Well, take the basic distinction in nominal syntax between count nouns and mass nouns.
Count nouns are things you can count, like one dog, two dogs. Mass nouns are substances you can't easily count, like water or sand. You say some water, not a water.
Exactly. And the grammar reflects this. Count nouns typically appear with articles like a or n, and they pluralize dogs. Mass nouns often appear with some and usually don't pluralize in the same way.
And kids pick up on these grammatical cues to figure out if a new word refers to an object or a substance.
Research suggests they do. If you introduce a new word in count syntax, look, a fendel. Children are more likely to assume fendel refers to a whole object.
And if you use mass syntax, look, some blicket.
They're more likely to interpret blicket as referring to a substance or material. Soja, Carey, and Spelk did key work showing this sensitivity.
But wasn't there an asymmetry? Something about solids.
Ah, yes. The object bias is very strong. Remember how infants parse the world into cohesive objects? That bias persists.
So even if you use mass syntax for a solid object, like pointing to a wooden block and saying, this is some blicket, kids might resist interpreting blicket as the substance would.
They often do. They're so predisposed to see a bounded solid as an individual object that the mass syntax, some blicket, struggles to override that conceptual default. Learning names for solid substances like wood or metal is actually harder for kids than learning object names, precisely because it fights this object bias. Syntax helps, but it doesn't always win against a strong conceptual predisposition.
Okay, what about verbs? Verbs seem really hard to learn just by observation.
They are notoriously difficult. Think about it. Parents rarely point to an action and say running, the way they point to a dog and say dog. And many verbs refer to things you can't even see, like think, believe, want, dream.
You can't point to thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how do kids learn them? This is where Lila Gleitman's idea of syntactic bootstrapping comes in.
Yeah, bootstrapping. Like pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, using syntax to learn syntax.
Sort of. It's using the syntactic frame a verb appears in to figure out the verb's meaning.
How does that work?
Remember the silent video problem. If adults just watch someone doing something, they're often terrible at guessing the specific verb. Is she giving or getting, chasing or fleeing? The visual scene is ambiguous.
Right.
But this sentence structure provides crucial clues. If a child hears, Mary is gorping the dog, the structure, a subject verb object tells them gorping must be a transitive verb, an action that involves an agent, Mary, acting on a patient, the dog.
As opposed to, say, Mary is gorping.
Right, which suggests an intransitive verb, something Mary does by herself, like running or sleeping. Or Mary is gorping to the dog, suggests a verb of transfer or communication.
So the grammar limits the possible meanings of the unknown verb.
It dramatically narrows the search space. It tells the child what kind of event or relation to look for in the world. Gleitman argued this syntactic information is essential, especially for learning verbs whose meanings aren't easily observable. #, the puzzle of number words, chapter 9.
Okay, syntax helps with verbs. What about really abstract concepts like numbers? How does a child learn that 3 isn't just an adjective like big or red, but refers to a specific quantity?
Number words are a fascinating case study in using linguistic context. They don't refer to objects, they don't refer to substances, they don't refer to simple properties, they refer to the cardinality of a set.
Which is super abstract.
Totally. So how does the child crack this? Bloom and Wynn argued that children use a cluster of grammatical cues present in the input to figure out the semantic category of number words long before they know exactly what 3 means.
They figure out what kind of word it is first.
Yes. They use the linguistic evidence to classify number words as quantifiers that apply to sets of individuals.
What are the clues?
There are several consistent patterns in how adults use number words when talking to children. First, number words are used almost exclusively with count nouns, never mass nouns. You say 3 dogs, not 3 waters.
Okay, that separates them from words like much.
Second, they are never modified by degree, words like very. You can be very tall, but you can't be very 3.
That suggests they represent something discrete, not continuous.
Third, their position in the noun phrase is fixed. They always come before adjectives. The 3 brown dogs, never the brown 3 dogs.
What does that tell the child?
It suggests the number word modifies the entire set, the 3 dogs. Rather than describing a property of the individual members, like brownness, it's quantifying the set.
Okay. Any other cues?
A fourth clue is that they frequently appear in the partitive construction, 3 of the dogs. This structure is a very strong indicator of quantification over sets.
So putting all these grammatical clues together.
The child can deduce that words like 2, 3, 4 belong to a unique class. They're not adjectives, not nouns, not simple modifiers. They are terms that specify the quantity of a set of individuals.
And this happens before they know that 3 means exactly 3 things.
Yes, that's the key finding. Analysis shows these grammatical cues are reliably present in speech to 1- and 2-year-olds, what? Often a full year before those children reliably understand the precise cardinal meanings, 1, then 2, then 3, which they seem to learn sequentially.
So it's a 2-stage process. First, use syntax to figure out it's a number word, a set quantifier. Then map that category onto your innate understanding of quantity to get the exact meaning.
That seems to be exactly right. Syntax provides the conceptual placeholder, identifying the type of meaning, and then the child uses their non-linguistic number sense, combined with observing how the words are used, often sequentially 1, then 2, then 3, to nail down the precise cardinality.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. The philosophical problems, the social inferences, the conceptual underpinnings, the syntactic aids. This brings us to the really big question, the one that philosophers and linguists have debated forever. What's the relationship between language and thought? Does language actually create our ability to think complex thoughts? we have to talk about the Whorfian hypothesis.
Right. The idea, often associated with Benjamin Whorf in its strongest form, is that language doesn't just express thought, it fundamentally shapes or even determines it. The categories and structures of your specific language create the categories and structures of your mind.
So without language, thought would be...
what?
Just chaos.
Whorf used phrases like an unstructured mess or a kaleidoscopic flux of impressions. The radical version is that language is the medium of thought, and without it, complex structured thought is impossible.
But based on everything we've just discussed, that seems unlikely. We've spent this whole time talking about the rich conceptual world of the pre-linguistic infant.
Exactly. The entire premise of Bloom's argument and much of modern developmental psychology contradicts that strong Whorfian view. We've seen compelling evidence that infants, before they learn language, already have sophisticated concepts of objects, number, causality, agency, intention. Their minds are anything but an unstructured mess.
So the basic building blocks of thought seem to be there independent of language. Whorf's starting point was wrong.
The strong version, yes. The foundational premise that the mind starts as a blank slate, structured only by language, just doesn't hold up to the evidence from infant cognition.
Does that mean language has no effect on thought? That seems too strong the other way.
No, that's too strong as well. The modern perspective, often called neo-Whorfianism, explores more subtle influences. Language might not create thought categories, but it might influence how we use them, or which ones become more salient or habitual.
Like making certain ways of thinking easier or more automatic.
Precisely. One line of research, associated with Stephen Levinson, looks at spatial frames of reference.
How different languages talk about space, like left-right versus north-south.
Exactly. Some languages, like Tzeltal Mayan, predominantly use an absolute frame. The cup is north of the plate or uphill from the plate. English speakers tend to use a relative frame based on their own body. The cup is to the left of the plate.
Okay, so the languages differ. Does that change how people think about space even when not talking?
Levinson's group found evidence that it does. They gave speakers non-linguistic spatial memory tasks, like remembering an arrangement of objects on a table after being turned around. Tzeltal speakers tended to reconstruct the array according to the absolute coordinates, while Dutch speakers, who use relative terms, reconstructed it relative to their new viewpoint.
So language didn't give them the ability to think in absolute terms, but it made that way of thinking their default.
That's the interpretation. Both absolute and relative spatial reasoning systems seem available to the human brain, but the language you speak constantly pushes you to use one system more than the other, making it your habitual mode of thought for that domain. Language acts as a kind of cognitive tuning mechanism.
Okay, so language can bias which cognitive tools we use. What else can it do? You mentioned it acting as a cue for categorization.
Yes, this is another powerful effect. Even if the underlying concepts exist, language provides a very clear signal about how to group things, especially when appearance might be misleading.
Like the dinosaur example again. Saying Triceratops and Brontosaurus are both dinosaurs prompts the child to generalize the hidden property, cold blood, between them.
Right. The shared label acts as an invitation, or even an instruction, to treat these visually different things as members of the same deeper kind, and to generalize properties accordingly. Davison and Gelman's work showed how powerful labels are in overriding superficial similarity when kids make inferences about hidden properties. The word becomes a catalyst for accessing that deeper, essentialist mode of thought.
So, pulling it all together, what's the final synthesis on language and thought?
The synthesis, following Bloom's line of argument, is that the core conceptual capacities we've discussed, understanding objects, intentions, time, kinds, number, are fundamentally independent of and prior to language. They are necessary for language learning to even get off the ground.
Language doesn't create these core ideas.
It doesn't seem to. Language is, instead, an incredibly powerful tool that builds upon this pre-existing cognitive foundation. It's a tool for communication, obviously. It's a tool for transmitting culture and complex knowledge efficiently. And it allows us to construct and manipulate incredibly complex ideas like higher mathematics or intricate logical arguments that might be very difficult or impossible to manage without the symbolic system language provides.
So, essential for complex expression and cultural learning, but not the source of the basic capacity to have ideas.
That seems to be the most accurate picture based on the evidence. The foundations are conceptual. Language is the remarkable structure we build upon them. #tag outro.
Wow. So this deep dive really changes how you think about something as common as a child learning a word. It's not just mimicry or association. It's this incredible cognitive feat drawing on philosophy, social intelligence, deep conceptual knowledge.
It really is. Every time a child learns a word, they're implicitly solving problems that have stumped philosophers for centuries. They're acting like tiny anthropologists figuring out alien intentions and like nascent scientists carving the world at its conceptual joints. It's quite amazing.
It makes you appreciate the complexity simmering beneath that seemingly simple surface.
Definitely. And it leaves us with a really interesting, maybe provocative final thought for you to chew on. If these core conceptual abilities, tracking objects, understanding intentions, basic categorization, are indeed present before language, what does that tell us about the minds of people who, for tragic reasons, perhaps never acquire language, like profoundly deaf individuals raised in isolation without sign language?
What does the evidence suggest about their thinking?
Well, it's limited and complex, but the evidence we have suggests that while they obviously miss out on the vast universe of knowledge transmitted through language and culture, their fundamental capacity for structured, abstract thought about space, number, even potentially others' minds, seems to remain largely intact. It's perhaps the most powerful argument for the independence of core thought from language.
So the human mind has this robust core that language builds upon rather than creates.
That seems to be the picture. The ongoing challenge, really, isn't whether things like theory of mind are needed for word learning, but getting much more precise about which specific aspects of social cognition are crucial for learning different kinds of words, nouns versus verbs versus abstract terms. That's where the intricate research continues.